The birth of the global melting pot.
Before Columbus, Europeans were basically in Europe, Africans were basically in Africa, Native Americans were basically in the Americas, and East Asians were in East Asia. And this is the way it's been for thousands of years. And then not very long after Columbus, suddenly you have places like Argentina and Australia being dominated by Europeans, Brazil being dominated by Africans, and Chinatowns all over the place.
That's Charles Mann. We talked to him about his terrific new book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. And building character in children means learning to get along.
The main idea of this book is to have empathy for another child, which is difficult to learn because children, you know, want to just think about themselves. And so this book teaches the skills of watching and listening to another person and remembering when you might have felt that way. And when you do that, then you're able to care about their feelings.
That's Sherry Miners. We talked to her about her terrific series of books for teaching social skills to children. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first spoke with author Charles Mann in 2006 when he came out with his bestseller, 1491. In that book, he revealed new research showing how the native peoples of pre-Columbian America reshaped their environment to serve their needs. Now, his new book, 1493, shows how Columbus's voyages created a new global melting pot, mixing social and ecological influences to such an extent that it created a new age. Charles Mann calls it the Homogenocene. It spread potatoes, tobacco, and rubber around the globe. It caused the first great world financial crisis, and it brought chattel slavery to the Americas on the back of a mosquito. Charles Mann writes about the intersection of science, technology, and commerce for the Atlantic Monthly, Science, Wired, and many other publications. You started this book because of a garden.
Yes, my garden, in fact, and really a long time ago, you know, almost 20 years ago now, I can't really remember why, but my son and I decided to go to a nearby college, Hampshire actually, to where we had seen that there was an advertisement that local students had grown 100 types of tomatoes. And I've always really liked tomatoes, and so has my son. And so we went to look at them and, you know, have samples, and I was just amazed by the variety of them. And also by the fact that so many of them were bred so far from where tomatoes come from, which at that point I thought was southern Mexico, but it's actually Peru. That started getting me involved in gardening. And as I did this, I would, time and time again, I would realize, you know, these plants I'm planting are from thousands of miles away. They have nothing to do with my home in Massachusetts, but here I am growing them. And even though I kind of feel like my garden is local and homey, in fact, it's this exotic modern object. And I began to wonder, you know, how many other things are like this. And turns out, quite a few.
It is surprising. I mean, we'll talk about some of these, but there's not only tomatoes, but of course potatoes and tobacco and rubber and sweet potatoes, which is a different thing from potatoes. Just an astonishing number of products and agricultural, you know, goods that are far-flung in the world and have changed the history of the nations. Tell us about this term, the Homogenocene. This is, you say, it's the age of the Homogenocene.
Yeah, it's a relatively obscure biological term that I think should be more widely recognized. And what it talks about is the idea that prior to Columbus, you know, before 500 years ago, the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere have been separated for millions and millions of years, with the result that there are completely different suites of plants and animals over there than over here. And what Columbus did was, you know, in effect, bring together the continents. And there is this ecological convulsion as huge numbers of creatures from over there came over here, and huge numbers of creatures from over here came over there. And it underlies a huge portion of the history we learn in school. That's really the subject of the book, this kind of ecological convulsion that this wonderful historian Alfred Crosby called the Columbian Exchange.
Yeah, and There's also the word ecological imperialism.
Right, that's another one of his titles. And what he argued is that there are winners and losers in this exchange. Overall, the process is a great homogenizing, and that's the where the word homogenizing comes from. That 500 years ago, in effect, the world became one. It became homogeneous. And the other sense I like about it is that it's homo, meaning humankind generated. A human generated homogenization of the globe. But there's plenty of explosions along the way. And when you homogenize something, you whip it into a froth, right? And so that froth is what we live in. And part of the froth is that Europeans often accidentally were able to transform ecosystems around them into what Crosby, who invented the term ecological imperialism, called neo-Europes, landscapes that have been Europeanized in a way that favored the conquerors.
Yeah, Jamestown, which is just a fascinating story that you go into, the first English colony in America, quite a doomed colony, however. Talk about what what was the landscape that the Jamestown colonists confronted, and how did they change it?
Well, the landscape they confronted, they thought of it as a wilderness, but in fact it was a greatly humanized landscape. It's just that what Native people did in the Chesapeake Bay, where Jamestown was founded, was so different from what the British did, the English did, that the English colonists couldn't recognize it as an artificial landscape. And so when the English came, for them a civilized, quote, civilized landscape was one where farmers were growing uniform fields of wheat or millet or barley or what have you, and there are fences around the land to protect it from domesticated animals. And it was completely different over here. By a quirk of history, there were very few domesticable animals in the Americas, and so Native people didn't have to have fences to keep them out or keep them in. Secondly, when they planted, they didn't plant uniform fields of a single crop, like a wheat field or what have you. What they did is they planted what's called polyculture. They planted multiple crops, sometimes as many as 20 in a single field that looked to the English like this complete tangle. And so the English would see these people in their sort of unruly gardens and, quote, unruly gardens with these, unfenced landscapes. And then they would see the fallow lands just beyond those landscapes, in which Native people managed the succession. So there's a whole bunch of what botanists call semi-domesticates growing there. And then beyond that, the woods, which were kept open by frequent burning and were frequently kept full of bogs and marshes and small lakes because of all the beaver, which Native people like both because beaver is good to eat and because it's easier to canoe around a landscape full of ponds than it is to go through narrow rivers, which is what it would have been without the beaver. So this landscape was dramatically transformed by people, the original inhabitants here, in ways that the English people couldn't recognize, and they couldn't survive in. They just didn't know how to deal with it. And the result was that a huge percentage of the first English over here died. Between 1607 and about 1625, almost 80% of the English who came over here died. And a parade of death year after year is just astounding to read about. And the way they eventually succeeded was by tremendous determination, converting much of the Chesapeake Bay into a landscape they could interpret, and the leading way they did that was by planting this Amazonian crop, tobacco, in big, big fields all over the place.
And tobacco was not the kind of, it was quite different in its origin than what happened to it when it came here. Talk about this tobacco cultivation. The Indians used tobacco, but not at all in the same way.
Right.
How did it transform the ecological landscape?
Well, so you have Native people with these very large fields, actually, but again, polyculture, with tobacco being, one of 10 or 12 or, even 20 crops. And it was a species, Nicotiana rustica, that the English didn't like to smoke. They thought it was too harsh. And instead, they brought in a different species, Nicotiana tobacum, same genus, a different species. And instead of just planting small plants here and there, they would take entire areas and cover them with a single swath of tobacco. And the result was to exhaust the soil. Tobacco has almost a magical ability to ruin the soil. Part of it is it just sucks up nutrients, and another part is that you harvest the whole plant, so nothing goes back into the soil. And the result was that they took over fallow land and planted the tobacco, and then it couldn't go back fallow. You couldn't use it again. And adding this to the English penchant for fencing off the landscape for their animals, because they introduced, the cattle and horses and pigs and so forth, meant that suddenly the Powhatan, who are the most important, group of native people in the area, were confronting landscape that was literally changing under their feet.
Yeah, and they really didn't see it coming. I mean, you talk about how the chief of the Powhatans, could have killed off the English pretty easily when they first came. But he saw how hapless they were and figured that, he might as well keep a few of them around, that he could always control them if he needed to and keep a few around for trading.
Right.
But that didn't turn out so right.
Yeah. It was pretty clear that they could have wiped them out at any time, but they liked the English trade goods. And particularly, not only did they like getting them themselves, but then the Powhatan thought, wait a minute, we can be the middlemen here. So if, some of our neighbors want English hatchets or knives, we can pass them along, but, get a profit in the classic middleman stance. And the whole purpose of this is negated once you realize that the English are going to come over in huge numbers. And this the Powhatan really couldn't credit, partly because they didn't realize how many people there were in England, and partly because they apparently kept thinking, well, if all these people are dying, obviously they're not going to keep coming over forever. But they did, even though the colony was a failure by almost any rational standard. They kept sending them over because it was important geopolitically in ways that the Powhatan weren't contemplating. It was seen as a a blow against Spain and important part of English nationhood and that kind of thing, all of which were outside the Powhatan's calculations.
And it was an awful lot of money to be made in tobacco.
Yes. Eventually it became profitable, although not soon enough to save the Virginia Company, which was the private enterprise that really set up the colony. And that's a kind of an amazing thing to realize, that the first English colony in the Americas was actually a private venture. It was a for-profit enterprise that was, kind of like a joint stock company, kind of like the sort of thing you have now in Silicon Valley, where you'd have venture capitalists going and funding some enterprise. And financially, it was a disaster, but it did lead to the transformation of Virginia and eventually to this enormous flow of tobacco, and then from there on to the colonization of much of the rest of the United States.
We're talking with Charles C. Mann about his new book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's a follow-up to a previous book, 1491, which we spoke to him about in 2005. Now, a lot of us think about cotton and slavery, but
Yeah. You
actually make an earlier connection here between tobacco and slavery and malaria. Kind of, tie those pieces together for us.
Sure. But tobacco is actually a relative latecomer. It doesn't really get to be important until the 19th century. What happened before was tobacco was the main crop in places like Virginia, and then rice in the Carolinas, also a very, very important crop. And neither of which could be grown in England. It was too cold. And the great question is, okay, you have these big plantations for export, a kind of farm that really didn't exist in England, where you'd have just thousands of acres all planted with a single crop that would all be harvested at the same time and then put on ships and sent away. And so you need labor for this. You need lots and lots of labor. And the native people were unsatisfactory for many reasons, including the fact that they just couldn't do it, and the English didn't know the landscape well enough to fence them in. And then after malaria came in, malaria did not exist in the Americas before Columbus, not human malaria anyway. And it was apparently brought over in two forms. There's two important forms. One of the forms apparently brought over by English themselves in the bodies of English colonists, and the second in the first Africans who came over. And it became harder and harder for English people to survive. So you would have a farmer here wanted to plant 1,000 acres or whatever, and the farmers would say, we need labor. They would bring in, the typical way to do it in England was to have indentured servants, where you would pay for their passage. They would work off their passage for 4 to 7 years, and then they would be set free and get to have their own land. Malaria put a real crimp in this, because it meant that most of the people who came here would get very sick for a year or more, and a significant fraction of those people wouldn't make it. And so they would be a total dead loss. And this wonderful, important British historian, Philip Curtin, did the calculations and realized that slavery made much more economic sense, because the people from West and Central Africa have genetic immunities to malaria. They're completely immune to one of the two types of malaria, which is called vivax malaria, and they're sort of, to put it crudely, half immune to the other. And he calculated that they were worth it at anything up to 3 times the price of the Europeans. And so if you had two plantation owners, and one of them brought over 10 English indentured servants and the other brought over 10 slaves, at the end of the year, the farmer with the indentured servants might just have 3 or 4 of them left, and the guy with the slaves would have, say, 9 of them left, and that person would have a big economic edge. And in this way, kind of nudged the entire system. And there's a striking fact that the bad kind of malaria, which is called falciparum malaria, is a warm-weather creature and can't survive north of Washington, D.C., and south of southern Brazil. And those are the regions where slave societies really took off, in the region defined by the presence of this type of malaria, falciparum malaria.
Wow. Although, of course, with climate change, that region is moving northward.
Yeah. With any luck, slavery won't be reintroduced.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very interesting what you're saying, because it reminds me of this book that was very influential in the way I think about history, and it's called Plagues and Peoples.
Yes.
And, you know,
wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book. And, you know, it just points out the driving role of illness, of pathology, of biological pathology in driving history. And that's a perfect example of it. Malaria really bringing, really being in some way the reason why slavery took hold so,
right.
So much in the Americas.
And the difference is that, you know, all the English colonies, including Massachusetts, where we're talking from, you know, had slavery. Massachusetts was, in fact, the first English colony to explicitly legalize slavery. But it never became a slave society the way, you know, Virginia and colonies to its south did. And a big part of this reason was the Columbian Exchange in the form of introduced malaria.
Now, let's move to the Pacific, because just as you show the connection between continents that is being made here by the slave trade and tobacco and these crops, silver really pulls the entire world together in the most interesting way. So explain how silver drove globalization and brought the Pacific into this.
Yeah, all the things we've been previously talking about, you know, the malaria and all the other aspects of the Columbian Exchange, were things that Europeans really didn't understand at the time and really didn't focus on. What they did focus on was the discovery of precious metals in the Americas, you know, first with, and most important, with Cortez, you know, getting all the money from the Aztec, the conquest of the Aztecs, and then a few years later comes Pizarro and the Inca and discovering huge amounts of silver and gold there. But the big hit is in 1545, roughly 50 years after Columbus, when the Spaniards discover in southern Bolivia something as close to a mountain of pure silver as geology allows, a place called Potosi. It's 13,000 feet up in the Andes, this huge silver strike, by far the largest in world history. And the amount of silver, the precious metal in the world, effectively doubles or even triples in the next 100 to 150 years. And it's just a tremendous gush of silver coming out of this region. And it's important because silver around the world, you know, silver coins are, you know, is as close to a universal currency as there is. Every society, you know, from Ming China to the Mughal Empire to the, you know, Ottoman Empire to the various European states, all use silver in one way or another as a currency. And so the global money supply therefore doubles or triples, and that is all linked together to this finding. And the silver ships kind of knit the world together suddenly, and we have whole bunch of effects from that, including the world's first global financial catastrophe.
The world's first global financial catastrophe?
Yes. That starts after, 60 or 70 years of frenzied mining. Soon there gets to be an actual glut of silver, and the value of silver falls. It gets to be so much of it, and governments don't know what to do with it because, they're dealing with effective inflation on a huge scale, and in 1640, a million Spanish silver pesos is worth about a third of what it was in 1540. They don't have things like indexing for inflation. They don't have sophisticated financial instruments. The banks have made a whole lot of foolish bets. The governments have overspent. And when the Spanish government goes down, all the currencies, all the economies, linked to it, they go down too. And there's this sort of financial collapse that spreads across Europe like a chain of firecrackers, one government going after the next. And I must say it was a little odd to be researching this and learning about it in the past couple of years. Because the same cast of characters, the sort of overweeningly arrogant bankers making foolish bets, the governments in denial, the fact that common people, of course, bear all the brunt of it, it's all there. All this stuff has been happening for 500 years. And now, it's our turn now.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Charles C. Mann about his new book, 1493. It's about how the Europeans' discovery of the Americas led to the homogenization of species and peoples across the planet. Talk a little bit more about China in this trade also. How, China at that time, I think maybe a lot of people don't realize that China was the richest country in the world at the time.
This, it was the world's most sophisticated and largest economy, and that's why Columbus was trying to get there. I mean, the reason that Columbus went west was to try and pioneer a new route to China so they could get all these wonderful Asian luxury goods, particularly silk and porcelain, which were these wonderful things that if you had some, it showed that you were a rich guy, right? They're signals of wealth, and everybody wanted them. And it took a long time for the Spaniards to get there, and it wasn't until the 1570s when they established a colony in Manila in the Philippines that they started this kind of continuous trade. And China had this peculiar thing. It was this very, very large economy, much larger than any individual European society. But they were in a tango because their economy was based on silver. The money system was based on silver, and China didn't have any. They had a very small amount. It wasn't enough for their needs. Before, they got most of it from Japan, but then they went and declared war in Japan. So they declared war in their own money supply, so they're kind of desperate for silver. And previously, Europeans had shown up there, but they didn't really make anything that China wanted. I mean, there's actual records of Europeans showing up in China with, shipload. The main European industry was textile, and the main textile was wool. So the Europeans would show up with shiploads of wool, and the Chinese had silk. And they would look at it and they go, what? Do you want a scratchy wool bathrobe, or do you want our silk? The answer is obvious. And suddenly with silver, all this silver they discovered in Potosi, the Europeans had something the Chinese actually wanted. These were shiploads of money, and they really wanted it. And so these ships, carrying silver, went across the Atlantic, and they had these other passengers the Spaniards at the time didn't think much about, but had huge impacts in China, and notable among them were these American crops, the sweet potato and maize or corn. Maize is what corn is called outside the United States.
Yeah, I want to get back to the maize and the corn for a minute, but you were just talking about, shades of the future past with the financial crisis, then the first financial crisis around silver, and the one that we are going through now. There was another passage you have on page 156 where you talk about the city of, I don't know how to pronounce it, Yueyang?
Oh, Yueyang, yeah.
Yueyang. And, in this trade now, Europe is hungry for these Chinese goods, so the Chinese begin to make European-style goods,
right,
knockoffs, very much like it reminds me of Canal Street, in New York.
Right. And the Europeans are furious about this, and they're very good at this kind of specialized small manufacturing. And much like Shenzhen today, there's this area it's basically southwest of Shanghai, becomes this absolute hive of small silk companies where they're, you know, turning out stuff at this absolutely tremendous rate, and they get tired of turning out bulk silver. They say, well, what do you guys want it for? And they start looking at European size. Well, heck, we can make those. And they have the world's most advanced textile technology. And they can make these products so cheaply that even after they are transported to Mexico, carried across Mexico, and shipped to Spain, they are still lower price than the homegrown goods in Spain. And so there's this cry from the Spanish textile industry and other European textile manufacturers, you know, stop the Chinese, they're underselling us, they're, you know, all the things that you hear about now. You know, so we have to have tariffs, we have to have trade barriers, we have to jawbone them, we have to convince them to stop. And so they set up all these trade barriers, which the Chinese and, of course, all the merchants who are making profits from, you know, the European merchants who are making profits from selling Chinese goods naturally figure a way around. So they say, well, you know, you can only, you know, have so many ships that come across. So they build the ships really huge. And they say, well, okay, the ships are really huge, but you can only put so many cases in there, you know, of such and such a size of these goods. And they figure out ways to really squish the silk garments into incredible numbers of them into single cases so that a chest that would be, you know, a normal sized chest might take 6 or 7 people to pick it up because they've squished so many garments in it. And so on and on and on with all these regulations designed to fight off the perfidious Chinese threat to homegrown industry.
Now, you mentioned before sweet potatoes and corn, and you say that it played a role in the last Chinese dynasty and the one that followed it. Talk about the sweet potato and corn. What was the historical impact it had on China?
I should make it clear that when I say the last Chinese dynasty, I'm talking about the Qing dynasty, which fell at the beginning of the 20th century, and the one that followed it. This is kind of my snarky way of talking about the communist government, which in many ways behaves like, you know, one of the past Chinese dynasties in its mixture of autocracy and benevolence. And what I'm talking about with the sweet potato and maize is this. They're introduced into China by a couple different routes, and the Chinese are very adventurous agriculturally, and they like to find new things. I mean, that's part of the reason that Chinese cuisine is so inventive and varied, is that Chinese farmers, you know, aren't afraid of trying out something new. And these are very different, though, than anything else they've encountered before. Sweet potato and maize, you can really grow a lot of them. You can get a lot of food out of them, as opposed to, you know, I don't know, growing something like lettuce. They're real, you know, staple crops. And unlike rice, which is the main staple crop, particularly in southern China, they don't require being grown in standing water. Now, the reason this is important is that China, which is this huge country, you know, has like 20% of the world's people in it, but it has actually relatively little water. It's only got about 7% of the world's fresh water. There's no giant lakes or anything like that in China. There's just these two rivers, the Yangtze and the Huanghe, or Yellow River. And so there's a relatively restricted area, it's sort of down toward the bottom, the mouths of both of those rivers, where you can grow rice. And there's this constant struggle in, you know, for millennia in Chinese history about how do we feed everybody, given that we don't really have much area to grow rice in. And these crops come, and sweet potatoes and maize will grow in terrible conditions and in bad soil. They're really kind of remarkable. And they come in, and the Chinese can move into the uplands in the west, where they've really not been able to grow much before. And there's not only are they growing so much more, they're producing more people, this big population boom. This, in turn, feeds the expansion out west, which requires more growing, more sweet potato and maize, which feeds more people. And so there's this, even as, you know, we're hearing about the American expansion west, there's a simultaneous parallel one that's occurring in China, driven in part by sweet potato and maize. And it has huge environmental effects, as much as ours did in the West, but they're much more disastrous, at least immediately, because all of these clearing of these mountains leads to catastrophic erosion. And the way it was explained to me by one of the Chinese historians who follows this, he said, well, just think of it this way. He said, we had a Katrina every month for 100 years.
Wow.
Because the erosions filled up those rivers. You know, and there's this phenomenon that happens when erosion fills a river, it builds up the bottom of the river, right? and the river starts to rise above the surrounding land because it's got all the sediment in it, and that's a recipe for catastrophic flooding.
The book is 1493. We'll talk more with author Charles Mann after the break. Stay tuned.
Esta noche tú te has crucificado entre los dos maderos curvados de mi beso, y tu pena me ha dicho que Jesús ha llorado y que hay un Viernes Santo más dulce que ese beso. Y tu pena me ha dicho que Jesús ha llorado y que hay un Viernes Santo más dulce que ese beso. Amada, en esta noche tú te has crucificado.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with author Charles Mann about his new book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's a sequel to his 2006 book, 1491. Before the break, Mann was telling us how the introduction of crops from the Americas to China, like sweet potato and maize, led both to fewer people starving and more environmental destruction. One of the tensions that you really explore is, you know, is globalization good? Is globalization bad? In other words, your book talks about, you know, the kind of environmental devastation that has been wrought by the invasive species, by invasive ways of agriculture, industrial agriculture, for example, with the potato, which the new world ways of doing it were really so ecologically destructive, whereas the old ways, the native ways of growing the potato were not. And yet we've gotten benefits. So explore a little bit this, you know, give us these two sides, this tension, and how you now, after having finished this amazing book, how you feel about it.
I guess I would say I feel mixed. That might be a proper way to think about these things. Because, you know, you talk about globalization. One of the big impacts of globalization was to bring the potato to Europe. And the great French historian Fernand Braudel might have been the first to notice this, but essentially the potato ended famine in Europe. Prior to the introduction of the potato, Europe's history is basically one horrible famine after the next. In the century before the introduction of the potato, I think Braudel calculated that there is more than one devastating nationwide famine per decade in France, which was one of the, you know, more coherent countries in Western Europe at the time. And the same thing was true in England. It was just, you know, the place was a basket case in that respect. And the potato comes and everybody can suddenly feed themselves. And I couldn't even begin to speculate how many people's lives were saved, you know, how many children were saved from famine and malnutrition. That's, you know, you have to have a hard heart not to say that this is a good thing. But the same thing brought industrial agriculture, which has its own pitfalls because the potato is really the foundation of industrial agriculture. And it helped European governments become more stable, and they then got to focus on the kinds of things that governments often like to do, which in that case was colonizing other places. And so the potato fueled empire, which is probably not all that great of a thought if you happen to have been one of the peoples that Europe conquered, you know, all these potato-munching Europeans conquered. And so the same thing, you know, this is just one example of the Columbian Exchange, the potato coming from the Andes, where it was originally developed by native people thousands of years ago, to Europe and becoming the staple food in this huge swath of Europe from Ukraine to Ireland. And you say, well, this is great, but wait a minute. You know, those now the potato nations, you know, England, France, and Germany are out there conquering places. So It's kind of, all these things are inextricably entangled.
And then another, I guess, the final question that I have, very, very interesting point that you make, the the interchange that's made, not, you know, we always think in terms of whites, Europeans and the Indians, but you talk about the interaction now that was set up through the Columbian Exchange between Africans and the indigenous peoples of the Americas, between red and black. Tell us about that tremendous, what were the fruits of that connection?
The way I think about it is this. The Columbian Exchange, this ecological convulsion, where all these I've been talking about, where all these different species were moved around the globe, also affected us. I mean, Homo sapiens, that's our species, is one species among many. And if you think about it, before Columbus, Europeans were basically in Europe, Africans were basically in Africa, Native Americans were basically in the Americas, and East Asians were in East Asia. And this is the way it's been for thousands of years. And then, not very long after Columbus, suddenly you have places like Argentina and Australia being dominated by Europeans, Brazil being dominated by Africans, and Chinatowns all over the place. It's this really a great convulsion in our own species. But the overwhelming driver of this, the most important factor in this movement by far, is the transatlantic slave trade, which, as I mentioned, is all tied up with the introduction of malaria. And prior to 1820 or so, 4 Africans crossed the Atlantic for every European, which is sort of a staggering thought, because you realize that if you're a biologist and you're sort of orbiting the Earth and watching this, if you could imagine that, what you would see is Columbus comes over, and then this wave of disease just does horrifying things to the native peoples of the Americas. And in the first 150 years after Columbus, somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of them die. And then, almost simultaneously, comes this tremendous onrush of Africans. And so the, biologically speaking, the real story here is the collision or encounter between Africa and Native America, with the Europeans playing a more peripheral role. And it turns out that as in the recent years, as historians begun to appreciate this perspective, they realized, wait a minute, what happened when those people met sort of out of sight of the Europeans? And there's an extraordinary history that's now coming into light of this encounter, and in which in many cases led to the creation of these sort of hybrid Afro-Indian societies throughout the Americas, and some of which were recognized as de facto independent states by the Europeans at the time, some of them lasting just a few decades, some of them lasting a century or more. And so there is a real landscape that was created from the interaction of these peoples.
As peoples of different racial backgrounds mixed, the very notion of race got more complicated in the Americas, Mann says.
Latin America, Mexico, was the center for the first little while of African slavery. That's where the Spaniards went, where they conquered these big areas, they had these huge estates, and they wanted labor for them. And so tens of thousands of Africans went to Mexico, and most of them were men, and most of the Spaniards were men. And I don't know if you've noticed, but men left to themselves will often do things that they might not do if they were entirely in their home country. Mm-hmm. And so the result was all these mixed people very quickly come to the fore. And so the Spaniards start trying to put the genie back in the bottle and say, these type of people have to be treated in this way, and these type of people have to be treated in this way. And then people begin playing off these rules, so that a person of African descent will say, well, I don't like being ordered around because I'm a slave, and so and will declare himself to be an Indian. He'll escape, and there's these conflicts in the Yucatan Peninsula between the, quote, black Maya and the red Maya, where there's, Africans going around saying, no, we're Maya. and the, quote, real Maya don't like this. Mm-hmm. And then you have Indians who are supposed to be kept away from from Europeans, saying, wait a minute, Africans aren't taxed because you don't tax slaves. Well, I'm African, so, I no longer have to pay any more taxes to the Europeans. And then Europeans will look at their mixed race kids and say, wait a minute, we don't have any heirs in the male line, and they'll yank the kid back and say, no, you're not African or Indian, you're European now, because otherwise, if we don't have a European heir, we'll lose the estate. And this goes on for a couple of hundred years, and it's complete chaos. So when people talk to you about sort of modern multiculturalism, I sort of want to say, well, actually, it's been going on for a while.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I mean, this is such a meticulously researched book. I think almost a quarter, I think, of the book are your notes, which are also fascinating. How did you keep your inspiration alive through this? I get the sense of tremendous enthusiasm that you must have had in writing this also. I mean, it just comes alive with every page. There are so many wonderful stories. Talk a little bit about how you did the book, how you did the research, and how you kept your interest going.
Well, luckily for me, this is, at least I found this to be a really interesting subject. And the reason that my interest was kept alive is just exactly what you said. I kept coming across these astounding stories. I guess the way I think of it is this, for when I picture the reader, you know, I'm trying to write to be read, of course. I imagine my dad, who was a businessman in the Puget Sound area, and he would come home at the end of the day of work and be a little bit tired and pick up a book. And, you know, if he was reading nonfiction, he wanted it to be fair. He wanted to be informative. He didn't want to be preached at. He didn't want something pedantic or condescending. And if he felt like the book that he was reading was like that, he would sort of pitch it into this basket that he had in the corner. And that was the, you know, throw-out basket. And I'm always thinking as I'm writing, how do I stay out of that basket? You know, am I going to that basket? And in this case, there, you know, I would read something and I'd think, oh, boy, this is going to keep me out of the basket for a few more pages.
That's great. And what does your dad think of the book?
Well, he passed away a few years ago. So, you know, but I think he would have liked it. His favorite praise was, my mom was telling me this the other day, was to say, I didn't know that. I'm not doing a very good imitation. My brother can do it much better. And my mom said that, you know, when I saw her a few days ago, you know, I think Dad would have said that a few times.
That's nice. Charles Mann, your latest book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's a terrific read, and thanks so much for joining us here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I like the show, and it's fun to be on it.
Charles Mann writes about the intersection of science, technology, and commerce for the Atlantic Monthly, Science, Wired, and many other publications. You can read an excerpt from 1493 by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, learning how to get along. This past summer, I stumbled across the first of Sherry Miner's wonderful books in the museum shop of the Hall of Science in New York. I was there with my 7-year-old granddaughter, and when I saw the title, Cool Down and Work Through Anger, I thought it might have some helpful tips for us. We do pretty well together, but like in all relationships, there are times when we have to negotiate our way through conflict. I was impressed by how well the author, Sherry Miners, communicated complex ideas in a simple but powerful way. I also loved the expressive illustrations that conveyed the book's ideas so well. So I bought the book, and when my granddaughter and I read it together that evening, we had a deep conversation about how to cool down and work through anger. I promptly bought several other books in the Learning to Get Along series Sherry Miners has written. And then I thought it would be great to have a conversation with the author on Writer's Voice. Miners has a master's degree in elementary education and has taught first grade. But she got involved in doing these books for a personal reason.
It was actually because of one of my children who had some learning delays that I was working on his program and how to help him. And I started just writing little books. And a friend said, you should really get these published. These could help other people. And I realized there really weren't, you know, books of this nature really out there. And so that's kind of what gave me the motivation to start.
Tell us a little bit more about your son, if you're willing to. Was it a son?
Yes. It's my son, Daniel. He was diagnosed on the autism spectrum. He didn't have a lot of, you know, language, mostly. But that really impacts social skills, which I didn't realize in the beginning as a parent. You know, when you do the questionnaires, does he play with other children? I thought, oh, well, that doesn't really matter. But I came to realize how much that really does matter. And we were working with Rutgers University, and we had a consultant there who would give us ideas of things that we should do. And one of the ideas was just to write little sentences for him. And I just kind of took off from that and decided to make illustrated stories for him.
And talking about reading one of those sentences, I'd like to read one of them from Cool Down, the very first one from Cool Down and Work Through Anger. And then I'm going to ask you why you started this way. And,
okay.
And I think it's a lovely way to start. You have a picture of a boy and his brother, I think,
mm-hmm.
in their common bedroom. And the boy is, picking some toys from his shelf. And he says, "I like to feel in charge of some things." Why do you start out your book, Cool Down and Work Through Anger, with that sentence?
Well, I like to start every book with setting the stage for where the child is or how they may be currently feeling before I work into what the problem might be. And I think that is sort of at the very heart of why we get angry and frustrated at things, because they aren't going the way that we want and we don't feel in charge anymore.
Could you talk a little bit also about the illustrations? How did you find this wonderful illustrator? And describe them for us.
Okay. Well, the illustrator is Meredith Johnson, and she's really wonderful at depicting the children and their expressions, which is really important to me. I didn't find her. Actually, the publisher did. And amazingly, I've never even spoken to her or met her directly. We've just done it through the publisher. But I was definitely looking for an illustrator whose pictures would really help with the comprehension of the book, because a lot of these books are for children who are not really verbal and who we really want to explain explicitly what the concepts are. And so the illustrations are really an important thing, the facial gestures and expressions and everything. So,
and the first one that I saw is Cool Down and Work Through Anger, something that all of us need to know how to do, and some of us can do better than others. You know, I read this to my granddaughter, and she's seven, and sometimes she has trouble with cooling down and working through anger. She was really fascinated by them, and I was surprised, because I was kind of afraid that this was going to be one of those books where the parent or the grandparent wants to impart a lesson, but the child is going to kind of roll their eyes.
Right.
And she didn't. Is that something you worked at?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the key things is that it's written in the first person. And so it's not the third person of an adult saying, "You should do this," but it's, "I like to do this. I can do this." And so it's really empowering to children.
And maybe we can just, if I can just read out some of these things, you know, as I said, "I like to feel in charge of some things." The second page is, "I might feel sad or frustrated when things don't go my way, or when I can't have or do something I want." And you have a picture of the boy who wants to get into a group of other children. And one of the children there is saying, "You know, you can't play with us," which is, you know, obviously a frustrating thing, something to make a kid feel hurt. And you start with that hurt feeling.
I tried to actually think of all the different ways, you know, young children can feel angry. And like it says, they could be sad or frustrated or hurt. And I think those are the three main emotions that underlie anger. Anger isn't always just present by itself, but there's some feeling of not being able to have what they want that's underlying it.
Now, I'd like to move to another one of the books, and I have to say, each one that I've seen has been really wonderful. I went out and bought a few more, like Know and Follow the Rules, which I thought was pretty good. There's also Try and Stick With It, Listen and Learn, Understand and Care, I thought was a really lovely one. And I'm going to give you some positive feedback on that as well. My granddaughter, she said, "What does it mean to understand and care?" And I was trying to explain. I thought, well, what is she really asking here? Because I tried to explain the word understand. She said, "I know what understand means." Mm-hmm. And then I tried to explain care, and she said, "I know what care means."
Mm-hmm.
She said, "But what does it mean to understand and care?" What answer would you give her?
Well, the main idea of this book is to have empathy for another child, which is difficult to learn because children, you know, want to just think about themselves. And so this book teaches the skills of watching and listening to another person and remembering when you might have felt that way and imagining how you would feel in that situation. So all of those lead you to understand what another person would feel. And when you do that, then you're able to care about their feelings.
You're really talking here about teaching kids how to build character.
Yes.
Is that something that you were conscious about? I mean, how did you think about these? Was this, you know, character building is big now, but I imagine when you started doing these books, maybe it wasn't so talked about.
I wasn't specifically thinking about character building at the time so much as social skills, because all of the things that build character really relate to other people and how we know how to relate to them. And working with children, especially that have some delays, they haven't developed their communication, and so just teaching them the basics about being able to talk and listen to other people, and you know, having empathy is hard for, you know, young children, especially like on the autism spectrum, that are only thinking about themselves. And so teaching them to reflect and to reciprocate things with other people, they're skills that have to just be taught outright. They're not spontaneously learned by everybody.
You also have activities for parents and for teachers. I mean, these are very appropriate to the classroom. What are some of the ways in which parents can work with these books?
Okay, well, each book does have several activities that teach that skill specifically. And there were kind of, I was looking at it, there's maybe six different ways that I've approached activities. And the first deal with just learning the concept itself receptively, and which means to be able to understand the concept without being able to verbalize it. So that's just the first step. If you have maybe a couple choices, that the child can point to the right one or pick the right one. And beyond that level, they could sort things into different piles. They're sort of different developmental stages. And next, they could expressively tell you an answer, or they could be in a group where they're telling answers. And then the next stage is role play, which is pretty big in all of the books, because for the children to be able to role play the situation and practice it either with puppets or themselves, that really helps them learn the skill. And then there's just other fun activities that might be expressive, like making a collage or a journal or a mural. Some of the activities are visual aids, just where they're making something that helps them remember the concepts. And then there's also group games where they might play a board game or a beanbag throw or a card game or something that's teaching the skill. So just try to make a mix of activities and pay attention to the different developmental levels of the children that might be using them.
And the pictures of the kids in the book are kind of, you know, kindergarten, first grade, mm-hmm. Maybe second grade. But I found that although they are within, they are obviously written for young children, that the ideas are pretty sophisticated and could really even help older children.
Yes, and that was definitely a goal, that every principle I taught could apply to anybody, even adults, so that they're not outmoded or anything. I didn't want to be talking down to children, but I wanted to give them sort of as much information as they could absorb. And some of it's built in layers, too. There's some symbolism and things in illustrations that they may pick up, you know, on a future reading.
Could you give an example?
Like the book Accept and Value Each Person kind of wants to make the point that no matter how you look or dress, you know, you're of value. And so in one picture, the kids are all looking at a fish tank, and the fish are all different colors and different sizes. And, of course, they love all the fish. And so there's little things like that can be pointed out, and some of them are kind of drawn out in the activities for parents to notice some of the little things that are, you know, in there just for a little depth.
And we're talking with Sherry Miners. She's the author of a wonderful series of books, 15 books in the series, called Learning to Get Along. It's from Free Spirit Publishing, and I highly recommend it for parents and teachers. My favorite is Reach Out and Give, although I really loved every single one. I've read five of them now. Mm-hmm. I think I loved it so much because, for one thing, it goes into an area I think that a lot of people don't talk to children about until they're much older, and that is service to others.
Mm-hmm.
And also because, as a friend of mine who is a preschool teacher said when she looked at it, she said, my goodness, this really covers a lot of ground in such an accessible way for children.
Well, thank you.
And so here, for example, you talk about activities. I'm going to, again, read a little bit from the first couple of pages, along with the questions that you give for parents and teachers to ask. So the first page says, the world is beautiful. There's so much to notice and be grateful for. And then you suggest that parents ask, or teachers ask, what does it mean to be grateful? And then asking the child, what are you grateful for? I mean, I think I was already middle-aged before I began thinking about how important it was to be grateful for things.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to realize that that is an important skill for the children to understand before they can be generous with what they have. They have to appreciate what they have. So it's an important skill to build towards being generous.
Yeah, and you also then make the connection, as you say, appreciation, you know, appreciating, being grateful. The one question you suggest is, have you ever thanked somebody who did something nice for you? How did it feel? And then turn it around, you know, has somebody thanked you? And how did it feel to you to have them thank you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, really bringing that sense of reciprocity.
Right.
I'm so impressed by that you cover so much territory in such simple language. Is this just something that came to you easily, or did you work hard to craft these sentences?
Oh, I did work hard. I mean, I think I may have a gift for being able to write succinctly, but I definitely spent months sort of researching each topic, reading everything about it, and kind of deciding what are all the important points that I want to cover and making an outline of it. And then the hard part is kind of distilling it and boiling it down just to the simple language.
And when you did research, tell us about that. What do you mean?
Oh, I just mean going out and just finding every book I can on that topic.
You mean, for example, on how to teach children to give back, or?
Well, just on just maybe any book on volunteering, or just trying to decide, you know, what is the essence of giving back? You know, what are the important, you know, concepts that I want to teach? And for that book, for instance, you know, that generosity requires all our resources, our time, and our talent. And there's a lot of different specifics. I think each spread is basically, you know, could be a chapter of an adult book or something like that. I think also using the illustration, showing children doing it, kind of brings it down a little bit more into a child's world and doesn't, you know, sound so abstract.
Yeah, they're really very profound. I mean, I'd go to say that, you know, they're not just teaching skills, they're teaching wisdom. Well, Sherry Miners, I'm just so glad that I stumbled upon these this wonderful series, this Learning to Get Along series, the books in it, Reach Out and Give, Talk and Work It Out, Cool Down and Work Through Anger are just a few of the titles. There are 12 more. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Sherry Miner's Learning to Get Along series is also available as a software program for classrooms. Reach Out and Give won an award for Best Children's Book About Volunteering. The books are also translated into several languages. Find out more by going to writersvoice.net. You can get a link to Sherry Miner's website from there. And you can also see some of the wonderful drawings in the books. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.